This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Nora Vincent goes to great lengths in the name of immersion journalism. For a book called Self-Made Man, she worked, played, and dated, disguised as a man. After 18 months, the deception triggered a brutal depression, and she checked herself into a mental institution. She checked out with the idea for her next project, a new immersion. After satisfying herself that she was stable, Vincent spent parts of the next year as a patient in three separate mental institutions, each with different forms of treatment: an urban public hospital, a private clinic in the Midwest, and an alternative therapy private clinic. Nora Vincent joins us in a moment to talk about her book, Voluntary Madness, My Year Lost and Found in the Loony Bin, and what she learned on her journey through those various facilities. And we want to hear from you. If you've worked in an institution that treats mental illness, private, public, alternative, tell us what you have learned. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the hour, new details about the alleged anthrax killer. But first, Nora Vincent joins us from member station WNYC in New York City. Nice to have you back on the program. Hello? Well, we're apparently having some technical difficulties reaching Nora Vincent at WNYC Studios. And let's see if we can get her on the line. We'll read an excerpt from her book. I began this project, she wrote, with the intention of exposing institutions. That was my prejudice. I had been to the bin my first time in genuine distress, had languished there, and left with the intention of lobbying for change. I wanted to show by doing that locked psych wards are not conducive to recovery or good health. In fact, to my mind, quite the opposite was true. You could take a perfectly sane, well-adjusted person, lock him in the hospital for a few weeks or even a few days, and his mental as well as his physical health would be virtually guaranteed to deteriorate. And now Nora Vincent is with us from WNYC in New York. Nice to have you back on the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Happy New Year. So you began with that agenda, but that's not the conclusion you emerged with.
Yeah, I really went in wanting to, I guess, expose the institutions. I thought that they were primarily at fault. In my own experience, I had certainly found them to be detrimental more so than helpful. But in the end, after going through these three experiences and really seeing what I thought was among the worst places and then among the best, at least in terms of money and access to therapy and so on, I really came to realize that the individual played such a large role in recovery, and specifically the will of the individual to partake in treatment and therapy and change his or her life, which really was what I came away with for myself, that you can't just get a quick fix, that you're not just suddenly well, that wellness is a process and a practice.
That though the conditions at the public hospital were deplorable, as you describe them, the patients would not have done better at the very fancy alternative clinic because they weren't interested, for the most part, in helping themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I came to, in some ways, understand the attitude that some of maybe the worst people at the public place that I visited exhibited, because I came to understand that maybe after a lot of experience, they realized there's only so much I can do for somebody who isn't willing to change and isn't willing to take responsibility. This is a big theme in the book, at least as far as I'm concerned, that, you know, mental illness, we are told so often it's a disease, and therefore what that means is you're diagnosed, there's nothing you can do, it's not your fault, and therefore you have no role to play, you have no responsibility. And I don't buy that. I know in my own experience it's a mutual thing. It may very well be chemical. I don't think we understand that process particularly well, but granted, even if it is, I think clearly, just as other health problems can be improved by lifestyle changes, this is also especially true in mental health, in my experience.
Well, going into this project, was it difficult to convince psychiatrists, doctors at these various institutions to lock you up, to institutionalize you?
No, and in fact, that was probably one of the scariest things about it. And people asked me that, and I said, you know, anyone could do it, really. I mean, if you that I mentioned in the introduction to the book something called the Rosenhan experiment, which was done back in the 70s by a psychologist and his grad students. And they did exactly that, where they presented themselves at various wards, and they said very little, basically saying, you know, I'm hearing voices, and they weren't very specific. And they were all, to a person, diagnosed as schizophrenic, and they were medicated as such, and many of them were kept for a number of weeks. So I think for me it was startlingly easy. It would have been easy to claim that I was psychotic. It was just as easy to go in and say that I was suicidally depressed, and just those words alone could get you committed very quickly.
You were still using Prozac at that time. Obviously after the last book, you had some. You went into an institution and obviously had some problems with depression before and afterwards as well. And nevertheless, you put yourself in a situation where you might well be getting other kinds of drugs. Was this wise?
Well, this was something I really wanted to resist, and this is where I encountered a fair amount of resistance on the other end, depending on where I was. It got better as I went along. I did a lot of research for the book about drugs, and I had had my own suspicions about how much we know, what they're doing, and in my own experience, the side effects I had undergone and the withdrawal from particular drugs. And so I really was very eager to stay away from any kind of added medications. And that was really very much resisted by the doctors in the initial place in the public hospital. Medication was really the go-to thing. You know, therapy, I didn't have any therapy really to speak of when I was there. I met with my doctors for about 10 or 15 minutes a day, and that was it. Now, in the second place that I went to, there was much more therapy on offer, and I was lucky enough to have an enlightened, or what I thought of as an enlightened doctor who understood my reluctance to take more medication and didn't force me to do so.
In fact, you went off your meds to get in there.
Yeah, I did go off my meds. And part of what I wanted to achieve in writing this book, because it really isn't just about these institutions, it's also about my own experience, and I wanted to change my own regimen, and I wanted to write about depression in real time. I think most people who've written about it have written about it in retrospect, and I wanted initially the second section of the book where I begin to descend into my own depression, and this dovetails with my committing myself to the second place. I originally wrote it in the present tense because I really wanted to kind of grab you and make you feel what that experience is like. And then also in the third section, I wanted to give you a sense of what therapy is like in real time. You know, what do you talk about? What are the nuts and bolts of how you go about taking apart your experience and changing?
Our guest is Nora Vincent. Her new book, Voluntary Madness, My Year Lost and Found in the Loony Bin. If you've worked in a mental institution of whatever kind, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's talk with Joseph. Joseph with us from San Antonio.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. Happy New Year, Joseph.
Happy New Year. Yeah, I used to work at a psychiatric hospital as a music therapist, and it was frustrating from my aspect or from my viewpoint to see a lot of the nurses knowing more about the patients than the doctors did, and the doctors were the ones responsible for the patient's care.
And what kind of institution was this?
It was a psychiatric hospital.
Public?
Private.
Private hospital. Nora Vincent, was that your experience, that the doctors knew more, the nurses knew more about the patients than the doctors did?
Yeah, absolutely. And I the first place that I went legitimately when I was feeling so awful after Self-Made Man, that was exactly what I found, that the doctors were really pretty arrogant. They really weren't interested in knowing me as a person. They wanted to fit me into their little prescribed plan. And it was actually the nurses and an orderly in particular who really showed the kind of human compassion that helped me to feel at least marginally better, that helped to allay some of my worst fears. And, yeah, they were the people who really took the time to give you that so-called human touch that really made the difference.
Human compassion that you found in short supply in the public hospital you spent some time in for this book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, to me, that was one of the things that was the worst deprivations. And also there was a rule, again, I understood the reasons for this, that you weren't allowed to touch other patients or physically interact. And yet there were a number of occasions on which I got to know patients also probably better than their doctors knew them, for example. And, you know, I wanted to show them some physical compassion. I wanted to hug them, and that you just couldn't do it. And it was a sad thing, in a way, to see that you couldn't have that kind of healing exchange.
You also wrote that it didn't take the patients long to figure out that maybe you were not really supposed to be there.
Yeah, that was also something that happened in the Rosenhan experiment, that people either saw me writing in a notebook. Usually it wasn't even that cue. It was just that they would take one look at me and say, there's nothing wrong with you, or you don't belong here. And I found that amusing, because I think one of the things that always has disturbed me is there doesn't seem to be enough, I guess, discernment on the part of a lot of doctors, where they can make the distinction between somebody who is genuinely depressed, or, you know, what is the difference between pathologically chemically depressed and perhaps a normal kind of response to a difficult life circumstance, which doesn't necessarily, like in my case with Self-Made Man, mean that you need to be committed to an institution.
Joseph, thanks very much for the call. And I'd like to ask, I mean, was this to some degree self-deception? Going in, you thought you were in a good place when you went into this first hospital. You're within 24 hours, you're experiencing again some pretty serious depression as a result of being there. But nevertheless, was it self-delusion to think that you were going in as an observer when, in fact, you may have needed some help too?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that, as I said, I had my own history with emotional problems. But I find it especially interesting, and this is a good example, I felt really good going in. I mean, I felt trepidatious. I was, frightened about what might happen to me there, or being able to get out when I wanted to, and so on. But yeah, there's a perfect example of a circumstance bringing about a depressed, defeated feeling, and very quickly. And that did happen to me within the course of one day in this public hospital.
Just one day.
Yeah, just one day. And It was pretty potent stuff. That's why I say you could take a so-called normal person and you take away their ability to, turn on their own light switch and read, or to, just walk out a door and get some fresh air and so on. I mean, those kind of deprivations, again, there are reasons why they're put in place, but they still feel pretty awful when you're feeling awful already.
I think it was the socks that scared me the most. We're talking with Nora Vincent about her book, Voluntary Madness. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Nora Vincent this hour. Her latest book is titled Voluntary Madness, My Year Lost and Found in the Loony Bin. In it, she writes, people have often asked me how I was able to do this so easily. I always shock them when I say anyone could do it. Getting yourself committed is very easy, easier than it should be. You can read more in an excerpt at our website at npr.org/talk. If you've worked in an institution that treats mental illness, private, public, alternative, let us know what you have learned. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. But before we get back to that, Nora Vincent, I do have to ask, and I guess this is a product of our age, when memoirs and journalists regrettably have been proven to either be exaggerating the facts or fabricating some of their material. Was this book vetted by your publisher?
It was, but also conveniently, you can establish that I was. I changed the names of the institutions and all the people to protect them, but there is a documented record that I was in these places for exactly how as long as I said I was there.
Under your own name?
Yes.
Okay. Let's get back to callers. This is Anne. Anne with us from Phoenix.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I had spent a good period of time in a number of different mental institutions as a patient. And when you were speaking earlier about your own willpower to get better, I found that it was extremely difficult to be an advocate for yourself because of the number of medications that you were on. Frequently, you would start medications as soon as you got there. And the doctors would come to see you early in the morning, and many of these had such a severe sedative effect that it was very hard to be articulate. And most of these things, by the time you left, because of the insurance companies and the number of days you could stay, you really weren't able to get anything working by the time you left. And so you were sort of in a limbo. And really, I think the difference between those of us who made it out and those of us that we kind of called lifers were really that there was someone on the outside who was willing to be an advocate for them, because you are rendered so helpless by these medications.
Nora?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very true to what my experience was. Everybody that I knew in almost all of these places, it was truly astounding the number of medications they were on. And many of them, yeah, I mean, at any given point in the day, one of my roommates, as I described, rarely got up before noon. And it's true, the soporific effect of a lot of these medications, I think, would make it difficult for anybody to form a coherent thought, much less express it. And that was one of the things that troubled me so much, was that there didn't seem to be much of a chance for people, to say, hey, look, I need to be able to talk about some of these things. Now, of course, there is that fine line of trying to medicate people, because in some circumstances it seems to be the best way that we have, at least so far, of trying to tamp down some of the delusions and maybe get somebody to a place where he or she can talk. But on the other hand, you know, clobbering somebody over the head, especially with medications we don't understand very well, doesn't seem like the greatest approach to me either. So I really do agree with you that was something I saw.
And under those circumstances, difficult to be that person of will that you talked about, who's participating in their own therapy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that. It's a paradox of it, really, because, you know, if you don't give somebody any kind of treatment, it may be difficult to get them to a place where they can partake in certain cases, obviously not by any means in all. But then also you have to do, once you do get them there, you have to be able to talk to them. You have to be able to interact and listen and, you know, react to what they're saying and try to include them in the process, because, of course, it's their very mind that you're trying to heal.
And thanks, and certainly that articulateness problem has gone away.
Thank you for taking my call.
Appreciate it. Let's see if we can get Andrew. Andrew with us from Chicago.
Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for bringing attention to the issues that seem to be in this book. Thank you very much. I wanted to follow up on a comment from someone else talking about how the nurses really seem, and other staff workers really seem to be the ones who know more about the patients than the doctors do. I was actually committed to a private institutional hospital in downtown Chicago several years ago for what turned out to be an allergic reaction to a class of drugs called neuroleptics. And it took several days for anyone to even approach me to talk to me more than saying, here is the routine medication regimen for you, take this. And it took even longer for a nurse of a specialist of the allergic reaction that I was having to bring to the attention of that specialist that I was even exhibiting symptoms of the reaction. It's just so amazing how overwhelmed that system is that the doctors have to become so removed from, the observation and healing process.
Nora Vinci, you describe it as a cynical process, that these doctors pretty much know they're not going to be able to help most people.
Well, and it's hard to say. I mean, there's a whole range of doctors, of course, and as I said, I met some that were very enlightened people as far as I was concerned, and then there were others who weren't. But I do think there's something that's real here and something that came up for me, which was, culturally speaking, I think it's kind of astounding how much unquestioned reverence we have for doctors and the word of doctors. And we assume, for example, that they have our best interests at heart, that they're healers, or that they know exactly what they're doing and that they're very intelligent. Well, none of that is necessarily the case. It sometimes is, and sometimes to greater or lesser degrees. And I do think that there is a problem sometimes with the way that doctors are trained. Of course, they're all trained in a very similar way. And to me, for example, I went to the American Psychiatric Association conference as part of the research for this book. And to me, there was no real evidence there of a kind of a more human approach. Again, we've mentioned this earlier, and I think this just continues to come up. It's this clinical approach that everybody has, that it's just chemistry, you know, that and again, a chemistry that they don't really understand very well, but there's an arrogance of, you know, I know what you have, I can diagnose you, but on what basis are you diagnosing me? And where is the test for this actual disease, and so on? And yet they behave as if, you know, you can really have no say in this. I know best. I'm going to do this for you and make it happen. And then, yeah, they overlook all kinds of subtleties like the one that our caller's describing.
Andrew, it all worked out well for you?
It all worked out beautifully because I eventually was released and found a more of a whole body, mind, soul, holistic approach to dealing with my issues. So it did. Thank you.
Okay. Appreciate it, Andrew. Thanks very much for
the call.
Here's an email from Penny in Sacramento. My experience in the past is that mental health services seem to be an extension of the area in which they're in. Bad area equals bad service. Better area equals improved service. Is it a function of the resources available, the money?
To some degree, that's true. You know, I would say that certainly the public hospitals are overwhelmed. They do have to take all comers, whereas if you can discriminate, as the second place that I visited, the private clinic, could do, you can create a different kind of environment. That there's no question. And the third place I visited did have, again, you know, greater facilities for therapy and so on, individual attention. They, too, could discriminate. But I found it interesting that when you think about the money question, when I got my bills for the public and the private and then the final place that I went to, the final place was half the cost or less than half the cost for the same amount of stay, in fact, a little longer stay. So you got to ask yourself, you know, where is this? It can't just be a question of money. Where is the money going? And this is another whole aspect of it, is what are they charging the insurance companies for these various stays? And I say at one point, you know, you could stay in the Ritz-Carlton and hire a private nurse for the cost of a 10-day stay in a lot of these places, and you'd be better off.
Here's an email question from Meg in Cincinnati. Given the concern about medical fraud and the corresponding effect on insurance rates, I'd like to know who paid for these not real mental health hospital admissions.
A good, very good question. This was a big process for me. I went into the first place and I wanted to go in under the radar, so I said that I didn't have insurance. They located that I did have insurance. And so they filed it through my insurance. I asked them not to do that. I asked them to send the bill directly to me that I wanted to pay for it. And they didn't do that. So then I had to approach my insurance company and ask them, you know, can I reimburse you for this? And that was true for the second place as well. And they thought I was nuts, literally. They had me talk to a social
they
worker.
They would have been happy to commit you.
Yeah, I mean, nobody calls insurance companies and says, I'd like to give you money, you know. So I could never get through the system to the point where anyone would take me seriously enough to say, you know, I'd like to reimburse you for this. That was my intention, but it just didn't come to pass.
Another email, this from Keith in Charlotte, North Carolina. One should understand there's a big difference between a nurse who has the responsibility of caring for a handful of patients and the doctor who may be managing many times that number, for how much time the doctor can spend with the patient and how well they can get to know every detail about the patient. Certainly the nurses and staff know more about the patient. They spend more time with the patient. The doctor and nurse are a team, with the nurse providing their notes and personal conversations with the doctor insight into the important issues concerning the patient. The doctor does not have to know the patient's favorite color or food to have the important information necessary to properly treat the patient. I don't mean to say there aren't doctors who do not try to get to know their patients, for I'm sure that's not uncommon, but please do not indicate that doctors don't care about their patients to the point of providing inappropriate care.
Well, I mean, to some degree, that's true. I guess the way I would put it is something that I ended up saying to one of my doctors at the end of the time, and that is, I think it would really improve the quality of this care if all MDs would have to spend about 10 days to 2 weeks on a locked ward incognito and see how it is to be treated as one of these patients. I think they would learn a lot about improving the care that they are offering. And yes, they are overloaded and they do have to see a lot of people. But, you know, to know someone's favorite color, well, that's a reductio ad absurdum, and that's not really what we're talking about. I think in a very short time, for example, in the second place I went to, I didn't meet with this doctor for any longer than I met with my other doctors at the previous public institution, and yet he showed a lot more insight and willingness to listen and accept what I needed him to hear. And that didn't take any longer. He didn't have to know my favorite color.
It seemed to be, just extending what you were talking about earlier, it seemed to be he showed a little bit more humility.
Yeah, exactly. And he was willing to say, you know, I don't know everything about you. I can't. I mean, that's exactly the point here is, because you can't in such a short time know these things, and because in part it is an exchange of I need to be able to try to take into account what you say will help you. Now, granted, if you're going to say, well, having a hit of drugs is really going to help me, street drugs, well, that may not be the case. And there has to be a certain amount of judgment exercised here. But I think that that's not too much to expect.
And the other thing, so many people are put in against their will, and yet it is, as you write the paradox, their will is what is required for them to get better.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big problem, and I don't mean to belittle how difficult this is, because you do have some people who clearly are, disturbing the peace, or they're in a very bad way. They've lost touch with reality. A lot of the people that I met in the first place were homeless. So you can imagine that those circumstances just exacerbate whatever delusions they may have already been prey to. And so it is a very difficult balance. And I understand, as I said at the end of the book, I came to understand that maybe just a lot of people in general, not just people who are suffering from a more severe form of psychosis, I think this is a problem across the culture. People don't want to partake in their own health care. People want to take their Lipitor and then they want to eat their cheeseburger. They don't want to realize, well, maybe I do need to take some steps and change my lifestyle.
We're talking with Nora Vincent about her book, Voluntary Madness. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And this is Paula. Paula with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi there.
Hi.
Well, I'm dying to read her book, of course, because everything she says is my experience with my mother. I grew up with my mother being psychotic, and I don't think she's ever been properly diagnosed, And but she had, I think, what she would characterize as sort of multiple personality disorder. I don't know if that's really true or not, but in any case, she was psychotic and hospitalized regularly against her will and on every medication known to man. And growing up with that, I'd like to say that the family was never brought into the healing process. Mm-hmm. And any time that she was institutionalized probably every other year throughout my childhood. I'm sorry, it's pretty emotional.
Yeah,
I'm so sorry. I can hear that in your voice.
We'd have to commit her to these places and then know that they were going to treat her like a prisoner, and that really the only ticket she ever had out was that she was very strong-willed and that she would take up painting or something positive for herself. And use that to help get herself organized, I'd say. Since then, though, she is off all medication. I think the medication, she's never been psychotic since she's been off all her medication.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes, and she's now taking fish oil and exercising and taking vitamins, and she started her own business. Doll making business and did very well, and so I think that since she's been off medication, she's done tons better. And I don't know what else to say about it, but growing up was very difficult. We were never brought into the loop, and I think she could have been treated she basically had, I think, like a post-traumatic stress disorder, and had she been treated sort of on an in-home basis and had the family brought in as far as as a support, rather than we were kind of frightened off as sort of, you don't know anything about this, she needs this medication, and she needs to, treated like a prisoner. And consequently, she, of course, did not want to open up and tell her psychiatrists and psychologists and all those people what she was really experiencing, because she was afraid of them.
Paula, I'm sure you're right about this. Obviously, in some cases, medications do help people, but she's got a point about working with the families, which is not often not done, Norvins.
Yeah, well, there are two points here. I think one point, and this has been argued in a number of books that I read, and some of them written by MDs who, to some degree, are pariahs in the profession because they're arguing against the prevailing point of view. But there's medical evidence to support that some of these medications can actually exacerbate the problems. You know I found that with my antidepressants, that when I went off them, I plunged into a deeper, much more profound and frightening depression and anxiety than I'd ever had prior to being on them. There's a kind of a rebound effect that can happen. So that's one thing. I'm not surprised to hear she might have been better off once she got away from the meds, even though, yes, for some people they can be helpful. The other thing, though, was, yes, the social isolation was one of the worst things. You know, the thing that I found helped most of the, especially the psychotic people that I met who were the more high-functioning, was that they had a community of people and they had their family members to support them. And I think that putting people away and isolating them is the last thing that's helpful.
Paula, thanks very much for the call, and we're so glad to hear your mother's doing better. Appreciate it. Nora Vincent, next time, could you try something a little safer? Boxing, maybe?
I'm going to run away with the circus.
Nora Vincent's book is called Voluntary Madness, My Year Lost and Found in the Loony Bin. She joined us from WNYC, our member station in New York. Coming up, we're going to hear more about the allegations, new details about the anthrax killer. It's the talk of the nation from NPR News. It's now more than 7 years since somebody mailed deadly anthrax spores to news outlets and congressional offices and killed five people. The FBI believes they know who did it. Bruce Ivins, a scientist at Fort Detrick, Maryland, who developed the anthrax vaccine used by American soldiers in the first Gulf War. Ivins killed himself last July, leaving no confession, and many of his former colleagues believe he was innocent. Yesterday, the New York Times published a lengthy portrait of Bruce Ivins, described as an amateur juggler with mental illness, alcoholism, and secret obsessions with hints of violence. If you have questions about the investigation and its conclusions, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Scott Chain wrote the front page story in yesterday's Times and joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And you say that Bruce Ivins was revered by his colleagues as a rare ray of light.
Yeah, he was a everyone recognized that he was sort of a quirky character. But a lot of people really liked him. He came across as a very caring person. He'd ask if someone had been out sick or if had lost a relative. He kept Hershey's Kisses in his office and people would come by and get him. He was a juggler, as you mentioned. He also played the piano and he would play a keyboard in his Catholic church on Sunday mornings and sometimes take it to an office party and liven things up. He sent lots of sort of joke emails around to friends. And, you know, like any government bureaucracy, USAMRID is the acronym for the United States Medical Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. It could be a kind of a glum place. And people, I think, generally liked Bruce Ivins.
And one of those jokey emails was spelling out happy holidays with anthrax spores.
Yeah, that was in 2004. He sent out a sort of Christmas card by email and said something like, the spores wish you happy holidays, and sent it around. It's the kind of thing that I think in the absence of the anthrax letters and in the absence of any suspicion from the FBI, people would probably sort of chuckle and think, here's a guy who was really into his work and had a sense of humor. Obviously, after the FBI's allegations, it comes across as perhaps a somewhat darker kind of gesture.
But even after those allegations, even after a lot of information about Bruce Ivins was made public following his suicide, after all of that, some of his colleagues really still believe he's innocent.
That's right. And they have some good reason to believe that. They knew him not only as a human being, but they knew him as a scientist, and they have some sense of what went on in his lab and what was possible, what wasn't. So I think you certainly have to take their doubts seriously. Four of his colleagues who had worked very closely with him for many years, all of whom have PhDs, wrote an obituary for the scientific journal Microbe that ran in November and praised him in very strong terms and didn't mention the allegations that he was essentially a mass murderer. So that gives you a sense of the the depth of skepticism out there at Fort Detrick.
And the skepticism is based in part on the fact that the FBI for several years suspected another government scientist, a man named Bruce Hatfill.
Stephen Hatfill,
who, again, you look at the circumstances, wrote a novel about a bioterror attack and had other very suspicious things about him. And you ask a very disturbing question in your story. Had Dr. Hatfill committed suicide, as some people suspected he might at some point when the investigation got very intense, had he committed suicide, would the FBI have named him as the killer and closed the case?
Well, that is a question that haunts, I think, a lot of people associated with this case. I started covering the anthrax letters when I worked for the Baltimore Sun and covered the case pretty intensively in the first couple of years. And very quickly, even though there was some Islamist or pseudo-Islamist rhetoric in the notes that came with the anthrax, for various reasons, the FBI began focusing on a theory that this was a domestic attack, probably from some kind of biodefense insider. And increasingly, the scientific evidence accumulated that pointed to Fort Detrick, possibly to another one of a couple of other government labs or contractor labs, and so they started looking very hard at the core scientists at Fort Detrick, at the Army lab there, and Bruce Ivins was one of those people. The irony was that at the same time, the FBI, which of course began this process with very little expertise on bioterrorism, depended on Dr. Ivins and some of his colleagues for their knowledge, their technical sort of advice about anthrax, about how the powder could have been made and where it could have come from and so on. So from very early on, the scientists out there had this dual status of advisor and suspect. Stephen Hatfill had worked at that lab in Fort Detrick for a couple of years, from 97 to 99, and was himself a somewhat quirky guy, and some scientists out there had suggested the FBI take a look at him. And the FBI quickly put together what seemed like a fairly provocative, at least, but totally circumstantial case that perhaps he had done this. And some FBI investigators were quite convinced that he was the guy. But they could not close the deal. They found some provocative things. You mentioned the novel. He had on his resume that he had a working knowledge of wet and dry biowarfare pathogens. He kept a sample of an anthrax simulant at home and some notes on weaponizing anthrax. They found that he had filled prescriptions for the antibiotic Cipro, which can protect against anthrax, 2 days before each of the anthrax mailings. And they knew that he'd lost his security clearance about a month before the letters were mailed due to apparently a questionable polygraph. They also found a history of sort of exaggerating his qualifications. They found that he'd actually forged the PhD that he'd used to get jobs at NIH and later at Fort Detrick. So it was really, you can see why they took an interest in this guy. And they put a lot of resources into him, followed him around for years. Last year in June, they announced that they were paying him a settlement in a lawsuit that he'd filed.
Because they'd leaked information about his name.
Right. Technically speaking, it was not for because they'd investigated him. It was because they had violated the Privacy Act by leaking information about him. At that point, you sort of wondered, well, is this because they think they have the guy who really did it? And in August, they announced after Bruce Ivins' suicide that was the case.
Well, you said they could never nail down the case against Dr. Hatfill. Could they prove it against Bruce Ivins?
With Bruce Ivins, I think it's probably fair to say that the case is considerably stronger, partly because Hatfill was a virologist, and there was never any proof that he had done much hands-on work with anthrax. Again, he'd done a little bit of work with anthrax simulants, whereas Ivins was an anthrax specialist, and for 20 years his job had been essentially to develop a vaccine, and part of that involved growing anthrax, essentially spraying it on animals that were vaccinated and using that to test the vaccine. So he was an old hand at anthrax, one of the most experienced people in the government with anthrax. But as with Hatfield, there was no single smoking gun, no single piece of evidence that could really close the case, as FBI officials have acknowledged. The letters were mailed in Princeton. They couldn't prove that Ivins had ever been in Princeton. He said he hadn't been there since 1959. They couldn't, the notes had been Xeroxed, had been photocopied. They couldn't put him, with a photocopier making the notes, copying the notes. They couldn't find any evidence, a security camera, anything like that, that found him buying the kind of envelopes, pre-stamped envelopes that were used in the attacks. So there were all kinds of possible items that could have nailed the case. And they couldn't find any of those. Now, they maintain that the accumulation of evidence surrounding Dr. Ivins, including a pattern of working late in the labs for several nights before each of the mailings, added up to proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which they believed they could present in court and use to convict him.
Well, that was opportunity. What about his motive?
The motive has always been somewhat obscure, but the FBI and others have long speculated that the motive might have been on the part of a biodefense insider, an American biodefense insider, to call attention of the public and the government to the threat of bioterrorism.
By killing people?
Well, there's some evidence that whoever mailed the letters may not have intended to kill or may have taken some steps to avoid that. Whoever did it put the word anthrax in the notes, put take penicillin in the notes. Now, if this were an Al-Qaeda attack, you wouldn't expect them to do anything that would warn people that they could take antibiotics and reduce the death toll. And there, you know, you can talk to folks who'd studied bioterrorism, worried about bioterrorism for years, and many people in the field were frustrated. They felt this was a terrible threat, and they feared that until there was an attack, no one would take it seriously. The irony, of course, is that if indeed that was the motive of these letters, it worked very well, and the government greatly increased the spending on biodefense and has spent about $50 billion since 2001 on biodefense. The irony there, of course, is that if indeed Bruce Ivins was the culprit, they've multiplied by 10 or 20 times, depending on what estimate you accept, the number of people and number of places where dangerous pathogens are being worked on. And assuming that, you know, in every 1,000 people, there's a couple with a screw loose, perhaps we have increased the threat of a biodefense insider.
Our guest is Scott Shane of the New York Times, who wrote a profile of Bruce Ivins, the man the FBI believes is the anthrax killer. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, email us, talk@npr.org. Jeff's on the line. Jeff calling from Chesterfield, Missouri.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. One aspect of this that I don't think has been discussed at all that I know of that I think might start to make some sense out of things is basically after the Democratic senators had received anthrax and other senators, one Republican I think as well, would that have allowed the government to start tapping their phones because they were the target of a terrorist attack? And if that is the case, boy, that really kind of opens up a whole can of worms. And when I heard that they wanted to wrap this whole thing up, you know, before the Bush administration was out with claiming Ivan was the one and he was dead and not too much we can follow, you know, up on after that fact.
Why would the government tap the phones of the victims?
Of the victim, yeah. Imagine being able now to have a reason to tap the
phone. What makes you think they did?
He got anthrax.
But, Jeff, what makes you think they did tap the phones of the victims?
Well, I'm just saying, if they were doing an investigation and they were looking for the terrorists, they would probably try every venue and you know to try and capture those people, and it would give them a legitimate right to tap their phones.
Scott Shane, any indication that the FBI tapped the phones of Senator Leahy or other congresspeople or the news media, for example?
No, I don't think there's any evidence of that. But this caller does raise an interesting aspect of this case, which is that there are many conspiracy theories out there related to the case. And many sort of amateur detectives who've made the case their own, and many of whom have come up with a favorite suspect. Some of them focus on Al-Qaeda and people they think are associated with Al-Qaeda. Others have a former boss in the pharmaceutical industry who they never liked, who they're pretty sure is behind this. And one of the problems, of course, with Ivan's suicide and the fact that there won't be a trial is that, in a sense, this is likely always to remain an open case.
An open case. Their colleagues of Bruce Ivan's, as you reported, liked him a lot, revered him. He was a person they liked, but they did not know about, some other aspects of his personality. He had a penchant for secrecy.
He did, and he seems to have compartmented his life quite carefully. His family apparently did not know that for for decades, he'd had an obsession with sororities and their secret rituals stretching all the way back to college. He had gone in the late 70s, early 80s. He'd entered some sorority houses, and he'd taken some kind of code book or secret ritual book. And more recently, on the internet, he'd left all kinds of postings about these sororities. His brother told me that he had no idea, even though he spent a week each year vacationing with Bruce Ivan's, his brother Charles, had no idea that he'd been in treatment for alcoholism, and he'd been in both AA and residential treatment. So he does seem to have been able to keep secrets and separate his life, which may strengthen the FBI's theory.
Yet there is still the question, did the FBI hound the wrong man to kill himself?
Well, that's certainly those of us who followed the Hatfield saga have that concern. Stephen Hatfield, according to his friends, was quite depressed and was drinking at the time the FBI focused on him. His friends described times when he would drive around Washington, and at times there would be a whole convoy of FBI surveillance vehicles following him. One of them actually ran over his foot when he was shopping in Georgetown, and Dr. Hatfield approached a car, and the surveillance vehicle tried to take off and actually ran over his foot. The intensity of the scrutiny and the constant presence of these watchers, I think, would put anyone under a lot of stress.
Scott Shane, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Scott Shane's story on Bruce Ivan's was published on the front page of yesterday's editions of the New York Times. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News in Washington.